Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Tuesday, May 31st, 2016. With me today, I have Brian Chaffin. And how is it going, Brian?
Mostly forward, a little sidestepping, and sometimes some backward motion as well, but it's mostly forward.
And see, this is how I know you, sir, are a good dancer. Adam Christensen from the MacCast. How are you, Adam?
I'm good. I'm going mostly forward as well.
All right. So I'm going to assume that both of you are good dancers. We'll get our community production of Footloose underway. But I'm thinking before we do that, we should actually talk about, you know, like technology topics. So, Brian, you were kind of mulling over what's going on in Europe with social network services agreeing to start censoring some of the content that people see.
Yeah. So this, let's see, where does the story start? Let me actually find where this story starts, because the story starts somewhere. Maybe I'll find it. Twitter and Facebook, YouTube, Microsoft, they're all working with, censorship committee in the EU. I don't know who the heck they're working with, but the idea is to limit some of the hate speech. For instance, ISIS uses social media really well for recruiting and for inciting folks to their brand of violence. Twitter's removed something like 125,000 accounts related to ISIS since mid-2015. This is all coming from TechCrunch. And it's an interesting thought. I mean, generally speaking, those of us here in the U.S. look at hate speech as a form of free speech.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost like a necessary evil, a tolerated evil.
It's
not even tolerated. It's just.
Well, there actually are increasing numbers of hate speech related laws here in the U.S. too. Mm-hmm. But historically, in the U.S., those who are keen on this issue, for instance, say the ACLU, have advocated the idea that we must protect the most vile speech. Right? We must protect the most heinous kinds of speech in order to have give any kind of value to the actual freedom of expression.
Yeah.
And I generally speaking, I buy into that, but at the same time, we look at ISIS using Twitter to recruit. Mm-hmm. Is that something that we want to allow? And part of me says no, and the part of me says, well, yeah, absolutely, because free speech is free speech. It's not some free speech.
It's a slippery slope, because who gets to set the rules? And then you have to start asking about biases in those rules. And then you have to, once you start down that path, right, then it's hard to define what is free and what is not free.
Right. Well, let's look at China. A country notorious for controlling information, controlling access to information in ways that those of us in the West usually consider extremely negative and a sign of how crappy they are, the government that is. And for instance, Google gets huge kudos from me for pulling out of China rather than allowing China to exert its censorship and control over what can be searched on Google in China. Right.
That was a big move.
That was a huge move. And companies like Microsoft and Yahoo, in my opinion, infamously did not. they agreed to the local censorship laws. And basically, there was a quote in here from someone about, I think it was someone at Yahoo, like, we don't get to choose the laws that we obey. And mm-hmm. which is kind of, in some ways to me, very similar to, I was just following orders, but, you know, whatever.
Right.
So, but here's the deal, Jeff, you in our pre-show meeting, you kind of nailed this one. And what did you say about looking at ISIS?
Oh man, let's see if I can say it as well as I did earlier. So when you're looking at ISIS, you're looking at a group that's objective is to create hate and create chaos and act as terrorists and disrupt the lives of people and disrupt governments. So you have a pretty clear definition of what this group is. But at what point does someone say that another group is?
Well, more importantly, Jeff, that's what China is likely to say about Tiananmen Square.
Right. Yes. And then when does another government or organization start defining hate speech to their own benefit?
Right. Right. Yeah. It's an interesting thing to say the least. It is a very interesting thing to say the least. And for those of us in the West, for those of us in the States in particular, which includes roughly the three of us, in addition to a few other people, it's easy to hate on hate speech. People targeting ethnic groups for racism, for hate, for calling for the death of Jews or Muslims or blacks or people from the Crimea or, I mean, you know, whatever particular ethnic group that it is you're talking about, it's easy to have zero empathy for that speech. I have zero empathy for that speech. I could not possibly express the amount of negative feelings I have about such speech. Mm-hmm. But man, it is a slippery slope, and this is made a little bit tougher by the reality of the internet, right? You know, some nut job standing on the street corner yelling hate, it doesn't have much of a reach, right? And I think mm-hmm. that's a lot easier to say, no, we got to protect that nut job. We have to protect his right to say his nut job things because freedom of speech is freedom of speech. But that same nut job given a platform on the internet can reach hundreds, thousands, millions even.
Right.
Which, again, is what ISIS has been able to do. ISIS has leveraged social media better than any terrorist organization in history.
Yeah, they are, for all of the horrible things that they are, they're also incredibly effective at social media.
Yeah. And, you know, lots of recruit far right wing here in the States has been excellent at recruiting across the internet as well. Various racist groups, various neo-Nazi groups. I mean, it's like the internet offers such a larger venue. And so, but again, you got that slippery slope.
Ultimately, is the speech the problem or is the organization the problem? Is it the ears that the speech is falling on that's the larger issue?
Well, from what standpoint?
From the standpoint of, so the speech is out there, and I get what you're saying about reach, right? So they have more power to reach, but isn't the problem that the people they're reaching exist and seek out that? I mean, you and I avoid that, and we denounce that kind of speech, and we don't tolerate it in our lives. But I think the bigger concern is that there are a lot of people who that, I mean, there's not, I shouldn't say a lot. There's groups of people that that appeals to, and that's scary.
Well, yeah. that's sort of the flip side of what I'm talking about.
Right.
The internet affording. The internet has absolutely afforded idiots an easier time to get together and be idiots.
But it affords the opposite as well, right? So it affords the good groups of people to find each other and the positive groups and the, you know, all that other stuff to happen as well. And I kind of see, you know, it's like you can't, I don't know that you can have one without the other.
You can't. No, that's, you can't. And that's that in a nutshell is the issue behind protecting free speech.
Yep. So Brian, right now what we're looking at is the EU saying, hey, we need to do this. And then the different social networks agreeing or complying. How would you feel if the social networks of their own accord and individually set their own guidelines that they strictly enforced for what they defined as hate speech? And then as a company blocked accounts as opposed to working in concert with a government agency?
I'm no more thrilled with the idea of corporatist censorship than I am with government censorship.
How do we feel about?
And it's a tough issue. God, this is not simple. What were you going to say, Adam?
I was going to say, I mean, we have to deal with this too. Apple has exactly what you're describing, Jeff. You know, mm-hmm. set policies on what is allowed or not allowed, say, in the App Store with their apps. And hate speech is one of those things. And they've wrestled with it with different apps and things like that, defining that. You know, we've seen apps get pulled that maybe shouldn't get pulled. We've seen ones that show up that, you know, many people feel shouldn't be there. So, again, it's this who sets the rules and who defines what is what and where the lines are. And it gets really, as Brian's pointing out, it gets really, really tricky.
Especially in this age of stunning narcissism and entitlement that we're seeing, where everybody on the planet, where so many people seem to feel like they have the right not to be offended.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the I guess that's probably a topic for another show, but... We are potentially, you know, I mean, the EU is not the US, and the EU has both different traditions, different legal system, and different expectations. And China is not the West, and China is not the EU or US. But, you know, we generally speaking, universally condemn China's attempts to control information. I'm just not sure how much different what the EU is doing is from what China is doing.
I don't know if it's really any different. It is in this instance more palatable to a wider range of people because of the organization that's being targeted, meaning Correct. ISIS.
Correct. It's true. But it's, you know, really in reality, it's probably shades of gray.
Yes. You know, I want to keep talking about this, but there's also another topic that I really want to make sure we hit today. So I'm going to have to break us off and move us on. And this is a topic that I'm betting both of you will have some thoughts on. So last year, we covered the news of when Apple bought a company out of London called Vocal IQ. And they're doing voice command technology stuff that's way beyond what anyone else has been doing, where it goes to the level of what we see in Star Trek, where people are just speaking in natural sentences and the computer is responding back. And so that's Vocal IQ. And that's come back up in the news because now we have Google Home coming to market at some point. We already have Amazon Echo on the market. And both of these products have leapfrogged what Siri is capable of. And now it's looking like Vocal IQ might be the element that gives Siri either a fair shake at competing or potentially lets Siri leapfrog both of those technologies. And I'm curious what you guys think.
Yeah. Well, first, don't forget about Viv also, which is from the same folks who developed Siri. And to me, the Vocal IQ technology feels much more like what we saw with Viv, which I think is a really important thing. The ability, and Siri had this promise early on, but it seemed to never, or seems to have not been realized. And my hope is that the Vocal IQ rumors that we're hearing is going to be the realization of where, you know, the next level of Siri goes, which is true interaction in terms of having context, having more intelligence as it relates to the data that Apple has that I have stored in iCloud that's related to me, and being able to add some AI basically to, you know, put things together. And to use things like my location and context and stuff. You know, right now, Siri can do a bunch of great things, but basically they're canned commands and you have to kind of give the right keywords. And, you know, and she doesn't infer or draw on a lot of things like, oh, I'm at home right now. So, you know, when I'm at home, these are the most logical queries, or when I'm referring to something in that context, it means this. Whereas if I'm outside of the house and referring to something, the location is different, the context is different, and I can infer more things. So, yeah, I'm super excited, and I hope it is something that is happening. And I think it also, you know, waylays some of the fears that, you know, Apple's been sitting stagnant on, again, if it turns out to be true, on Siri.
Yes. And, okay, now, Brian, the part that I'm curious what you think is the whole thing with privacy, because that's been one of the big stumbling blocks for Siri, since Apple isn't willing to mine our personal data in the way that Google is. Siri has felt held back. Do you think that something like Vocal IQ, with the way it can learn and adapt and remember context, will be enough to let Apple compete?
Well, yeah, that has been the line that that I've taken and that we've talked about on a couple different podcasts. Did you see the email from Mathis Strellett?
No.
He actually wrote in for our discussion on the Apple Context Machine, a different podcast.
But, that's why I'm not seeing it. I'm not looking at the right mailbox.
But here we are here. He talks about the ability to make up for the lack of big data with enhanced language parsing abilities. And which is really interesting, but where is it? Because it ain't there yet in Siri. And I actually think that if there's a company that can solve this issue, and this issue being how to use machine learning without violating our privacy, if there's a company that can do that, it's probably Apple.
That's my assumption as well.
But I don't see where it's how it's going to happen. And the reason why I can't see it, let me rephrase that. It's difficult for us to see what Apple's doing because Apple is notoriously secret. And in fact, Apple's penchant for secrecy has supposedly interfered with its efforts to grow its internal artificial intelligence and machine learning capabilities, because that entire community tends to be extremely open, publishing a lot of white papers, going to conferences, giving presentations at conferences, talking to people at conferences. And these are things that Apple doesn't, generally speaking, do. If Apple goes to a conference, it tends not to be speaking. Tends to be listening, and that just sort of like makes people cranky, supposedly, in the AI and machine learning communities. So it's hard to see how Apple is going to overcome this, but and that leads to, like, you know, me saying things like, I want Apple to learn more about me because I trust Apple not to use that information against me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The thing is they already do know a lot about us. And that's been my frustration with Siri so far, is the lack of smarts or intelligence or context around the data that they already have. And the most concrete example that I have is it frustrates me to no end that I set up meeting events and things in my calendar where I take the time, or it's pretty easy to do now because it senses it. But, you know, my calendar has address data. It has location information. And the fact that I can't ask Siri to give me directions to my next meeting just drives me insane. It seems like such a simple thing. They already have the data. They don't need to go outside anywhere to get that data.
Yeah, but this comes into Tim Cook's thing about how Apple News doesn't need to know what song you're listening to. Apple might have this information, but Apple has built these walls to keep one hand from knowing what the other hand is doing. And that's the issue that I'm talking about.
But the wall that I'm describing doesn't exist. I mean, the operating system has access to all of the calendar data and all the information that's in the calendar. So, you know, and that's centrally located. If I'm using iCloud, it's stored on iCloud servers. I know that that's happening. So, I mean, I get your point, but again, they can mine their own internal data without breaking any privacy and going, the privacy thing is when a third party or an outside service wants an exchange of data or information for access to their data, right? I mean, that's typically how it happens in other systems. So, you know, such and such company who's going to sell stuff wants access to all of the customer data. And Apple's already built some pretty sophisticated systems that where they could make that a one-way street. The bigger challenge for them, I think, is getting access to the third-party data, convincing other companies to give them access to outside data without an exchange of information. And Apple's historically been pretty good at doing that so far, but it slows them down, which is why I think they're a little bit behind on this, because they don't have the advantages of a Google or an Amazon who is just fully willing to take their customers' data and hand it off to a third party.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's holding Apple back. But on the other hand, I kind of like the idea that Apple isn't willing to play fast and loose with our personal data.
Oh, I love that fact. And I mean, for example, you know, one of the big examples you'll see on other platforms right now is the ability to buy and order things, right, directly with your voice. So you can use your Amazon Echo or whatever to order something on Amazon. Again, sometimes those Amazon products come from third parties. And I would imagine, I haven't looked into this deeply, but I would imagine that all of your customer data, if it's an Amazon partner or whatever they call their associates, right, that data and information is shared willingly. Now, Apple could also set up integrations with other companies, say using something like Apple Pay, right? Which Apple Pay generates one-off tokens for transactions. They can hold back tracking information. They obviously have to give in exchange of, say, shipping data. But if Apple's doing the whole payment processing, if they're doing all that stuff, they could potentially open up something like that through voice technology and, again, keep the access to the information limited. The challenge is going to be getting that partner on the other side to agree, hey, we're only going to give you, you know, a shipping address and that's it. That's all you're going to get.
Yeah, we're out of time. But, Brian, if you have any thoughts you want to add to this before we wrap up, hit me now.
No, you know, I've got a lot of thoughts. I've got a lot of thoughts kicking around on this, and I think I've said what I need to say for now.
All right. Well, when you decide you have more to say, I'm looking to hear what that is. And we really are out of time. So, Brian, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, yeah. Always awesome. And Adam, thank you for taking the time to be here as well.
Oh, you're welcome. More than welcome. Always a pleasure to be on.
It's always great to have you. And listeners, it's always great that you are here, too. Thanks for listening. We'll see everyone again tomorrow.